Now, in her major new history series, Professor Kathy Willis, the Director of Science at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, continues her exploration of our changing relationship with plants, past and present, in Plants, From Roots to Riches.
What links lettuce, car tyres, dandelions and a smuggled consignment of 70,000 tree seeds? The answer is rubber. Not many discoveries can genuinely be said to have changed the world. This one did. Without it, your daily life would be wetter, noisier, more dangerous. And for the English at least, it all started here at Kew. Natural rubber derived from latex had long been a curiosity. A soft, springy substance that magically reformed its shape. As early as 1734, it had been noticed by a French explorer, Condamine, as a substance for waterproofing dwellings by the Amazonian Indians, just the sort of thing to inspire the new breed of scientific entrepreneur such as Nelson Goodyear, who'd sprung out of the white heat of the Industrial Revolution. In 1839, he discovered that by heating rubber with sulfur and lead, a process known as vulcanization, it stayed flexible even in extreme cold and heat. It was still rubber, but not as previously known. The potential for rubber now seemed endless. At the Great Exhibition of 1851, Goodyear displayed many wonders and curiosities made from this strange natural substance by his new method. So did Mackintosh, a Glaswegian chemist who greatly improved the quality of rubberized fabric by sandwiching a layer of rubber between two layers of cloth, leading, of course, to the fashion accessory of the time, a Mackintosh rubberized raincoat. Items from the Great Exhibition are now kept here in the Economic Botany Collection at Kew, where Mark Nesbitt is the curator.
Here we've got jewellery made by Goodyear, and what you can see is these are in fact demonstration pieces. We've got chains here to show that, you know, with rubber you can make complicated moving things. This beautiful brooch of deer where the rubber has flowed through the antlers to be cast into a brooch.
I love the earrings, they're particularly nice.
Yes.
They look like they're sort of a knot that's been tied. Presumably it was rubber that then was formed into a knot and then placed on an earring. Fantastic.
And what you'll notice is that all of these rubber objects are black, and these are hard. You can see that they were made to be hard at the time of use. That's because these are heavily vulcanized. And this kind of rubber is called ebonite because of its resemblance to ebony.
So these are very glamorous. What were the less glamorous parts of the vulcanization process and rubber that came through from that?
The less glamorous objects are in a way the more important in a collection. So we're looking here at four sort of greyish rubber rings, nicely packed in an acid-free box. And these are our gaskets, so to go in between iron or steel pipes. If you think the main source of power in the 19th century, by the time rubber comes along, is steam. And so when you have steam flowing through pipes, every time pipes join each other, you have to have a rubber gasket. So there are all kinds of mundane but extremely important industrial uses for rubber.
Central to the spread of new ideas and intellectual curiosity was Prince Albert. His support for the Great Exhibition gave it the official seal of approval. The story goes that he and Queen Victoria were stopped in their tracks at the Mackintosh stand and presented with a tablet of vulcanized rubber, engraved upon which was Charity, a religious poem by the popular hymn writer William Cowper.
The band of commerce was designed to associate all the branches of mankind, and if a boundless plenty be the robe, trade is the golden girdle of the globe. Each climate needs what other climes produce, and offers something to the general use.
It was a brilliant PR exercise, and significantly, the poem captured the moment. God had placed his natural riches in abundance all around the world, and trading them by whatever means for the common good was a noble endeavour. But as so often with the sudden exploitation of a natural resource, there was a problem. Demand was beginning to outstrip supply of wild rubber. Bolivia, Brazil and Peru had experienced a boom in the rubber trade. The botanist Richard Spruce had made a solitary trip through the Amazon region in the 1850s. He'd seen reckless destruction of thousands of trees through indiscriminate slashing and overtapping for rubber trees for latex. Something had to be done. A report commissioned by the India Office in 1871 recommended that Britain generate and maintain its own stocks of rubber in India. and to do this by taking one of the most high-yielding rubber species, Hevea brasiliensis, from South America and growing it like a crop in plantations in India. Q was to be the central cog in this transfer process. It was to get the species from South America to the colonies. After all, there were good precedents for this sort of approach. Q already had success in getting quinine out of South America and cultivating it to ease the British conquest of India in the face of malaria. So the question was, could a similar success be achieved with rubber? Enter Henry Wickham.
I'm probably alone among British planters and forestry men, having also had working experience with rubber in the native forest, and therefrom know the natural habitat and requirement of these trees.
Henry Wickham, a restless wanderer, one-time coffee planter and trader in bird skins in the Amazon. Could Wickham be our man in the Brazilian jungle? His boastful travel diaries and his attempts at botanical drawings certainly persuaded the India Office at least, and they instructed Kew's director Joseph Hooker to look upon him favourably. Historian Emma Rice.
We don't have the text of Hooker's reply, but it seems to have been pretty terse to judge by Hooker's notes. From his point of view, Wickham was unqualified with no botanical expertise, no horticultural expertise, son of a solicitor, not a person of great social status, somebody getting up to who knows what in the Amazon. And on top of all that, he had the temerity to ask to be paid.
Hooker was notoriously sensitive to status, especially his own. Wickham, a mere travelling adventurer, was demanding more money than a gentleman botanist would expect to live on. Hooker dismissed the request out of hand, but by 1873, the price of rubber had outstripped the price of silver. Supplies were at a premium. The situation was rapidly becoming urgent. The India Office contacted Hooker again, this time with some alarm.
Suddenly, Joseph Hooker was more than willing to paint Henry Wickham as Q and his best friend. He wrote to say, "I have a correspondent in Santarema upon the Amazons who is engaged on the business of rubber collection," very much giving the impression that this was something he had planned all along.
"And your offer of £10 per 1,000 seeds is sufficiently liberal, but it'll only be adequate if a considerable volume of seeds is to be purchased."
So it's clear that both Wickham and Hooker were aware of the economic imperative for rubber production. But Hooker also knew that failure would come at a heavy price. Richard Spruce had almost died of malaria in pursuit of cinchona, and neither Kew nor the Indian Office had any wish to lose a botanist unnecessarily in the equally dangerous pursuit of rubber. But Kew was also taking a big risk with Wickham. His horticultural skills, let alone his botanical credentials, were thin. So why is Kew putting all its faith in this man? Jim Endersby explains.
They're still trying to prove their value to the nation and to the empire to ensure their continued funding. But I think perhaps the other model for botany is what's been going on with geology. Geology has become a much more prestigious and important science, partly because it has demonstrated its ability to predict where you should dig for gold. And there's been a gold rush in Australia in the middle of the century, built on a prediction by a leading British geologist. And I think that botanists get a gleam in their eye. They can see the possibility that properly worked out science of plant geography, of acclimatization and transplantation, all of these things will come together into an ability to find new sources of plant wealth for the empire, to demonstrate their value to the empire, but also to demonstrate their power as a proper science able to make predictions.
With commission in hand then, Henry Wickham, according to his colourful memoir, would have us believe that he crated up 70,000 seeds and, in the face of armed customs officers at Para, declared his crates to be carrying
exceedingly delicate botanical specimens specially designated for delivery to Her Britannic Majesty's own royal garden at Kew.
His apparent subterfuge worked, and it was full steam ahead for England before the delicate seeds perished.
Fatally, it's said that the letter of commission was meant to refer to barbel or living seeds, but that was left out. That's very important in the Wickham story.
So 70,000 seeds came back to Kew.
Of which 4% germinated,
4%?
Less than 2,500, yes.
Goodness, why so few?
Well, there's evidence that Wickham was collecting seeds over quite a long period, despite knowing that rubber seeds don't live for very long. If they dry out, they die. But once you have seedlings, you can start to take cuttings, and then you can multiply up the number of plants. And then the seedlings were sent to botanic gardens all over the world, in fact, not only to the British Empire.
So, in effect, Kew was acting as the clearinghouse. The seeds were coming in, they were then developing them, they were creating seedlings, then sending them out to all these other countries.
Well, it was much more than just plants going in and out. What the founders of modern Kew understood is two things, really. One, that if you know the name of the plant, you already start to know its properties. You start to be able to get a handle on all of its diverse uses. But also, if you look at it in its ecological context of where does it grow, you can then predict where it can be successfully grown in other places. So, for example, the Brazilian rubber tree, Javier brasiliensis, grows in the Amazon. So if you're looking for a climatic analogue, you're looking for somewhere that's hot and wet, which takes you, in the case of Britain, to the Far East, to India, to Burma, to Malaysia.
Transporting rubber seeds is challenging enough, but how do you carry even more delicate seedlings around the world? Jim Endersby.
Well, it's not easy. As you can imagine, we're relying on sailing ships. It takes a long time. If you put the plants up on deck where they get light, they also get covered in seawater, and you've got to move them through a great many different climates. So one of the things that's done is the building of small portable greenhouses, which become known as Wardian cases. They're named after a man called Nathaniel Bagshaw Ward, who, in, I think, rather classically Victorian style, doesn't actually invent them. He perfects an existing design, gives his name to it, publicises it, and he becomes known as the inventor forevermore. The principle Ward has hit on very simply is you seal the case, you stop the salt water getting in, the plant's respiration recycles the moisture and the oxygen and the carbon dioxide in the case. All of that wasn't known at the time, but that's what's going on. Of course, it didn't always work quite that well. Ships' captains did not like having Wardian cases cluttering up their deck when they were trying to muster all hands to raise or lower sails in a storm. The last thing they wanted was to be stepping around greenhouses. And so they would shove them in the cargo hold, and you can imagine what that did for them. On one occasion, somebody packed a case, great diligence, great concern for the plants and the glass. They wrapped the entire case in canvas and then had it coated with pitch to make it waterproof. So, as you can imagine, the plants were completely dead in this coffin when they got to the other end.
It was a really hit-and-miss business. For example, seeds were sent to Singapore, but no one collected them from the port. They were all dead by the time that they were found.
The port authorities let the whole rubber trade down.
Yeah. So seeds were sent to all kinds of hot, wet areas. But widespread experiments in India pretty much all failed. And it's when rubber moved to Singapore and then on to Malaya that it found its first niche, if you like, of a really hot, really wet country, very similar in climate to the Amazon.
Using Wickham's apparently smuggled seeds, Malaya built up its rubber plantations, and by 1910 they overtook Brazil. The key figure in Malay's success was Henry Ridley, director of Singapore Botanic Garden. Mad Rubber Ridley, as he was known, would enthusiastically press rubber seeds into the palms of any district official, and it was he who developed a new method of tapping latex which preserved the productive life of rubber trees. Brazil, meanwhile, would go on to prosper with another plant it had acquired from overseas, coffee. However, it wasn't only rubber that was reflecting the commercial and political importance of plants at this point in time. The passion for plant products across the globe was also extending to their cultural value. And as we'll hear, affordable exotic beauties that up to now had defied expertise were igniting Victorian desires on home soil. And this would usher in a new era of cultivation for all.
That was Professor Cathy Willis with Plants From Roots to Riches. The readers were Ian Redford and Clive Haywood, and the series is produced by Adrian Washbourne.